Welcome back to the Speak the Unspoken podcast. Today, I was chatting with Michael Gormley, affectionately known as Gomer, to his audience on the Catching Foxes podcast. And if you enjoyed the show, you can take a listen to more Catching Foxes wherever you find your podcasts. Today, we were actually talking about whether or not the church needs a new ministry model. And we talked about technology, we talked about ministry, we talked about all sorts of things. And I hope you enjoyed the show as much as I did.
This is the Speak the Unspoken podcast, where we help parishes and dioceses unlock their ministry potential. Our goal is to host the conversation for you and ministry leaders on how to reach people in a post-Christendom era. We hope you enjoy the show.
So here's why I wanted to chat with you today. We are discerning that there's something up and that the church is, this new ministry model is evolving in the church. And we see it in pockets everywhere. And we called it a new ministry model, not because it's necessarily new in like the fundamental truths that get worked out with it, like how to, it's not a doctrinal newness or anything along those lines, but it's new in that there's something happening in the times that we're living in this day and age, that as this book by Prime Matters out of the University of Mary, we're actually at a change of age and we're moving into a new age. And we kind of feel this, but because we've lived through it, we don't really think too much about it. But we've gone through the most significant technological shift in not only our lifetimes, but probably the history of the world. It's the smartphone, the internet, they're more disruptive than the printing press by a lot. And because of that, we're seeing this new ministry model emerge, and ministry being the right ordering of relationships according to the kingdom of God, right? So husband to wife, parent to child, society to the poor, like all, there's just the right ordering of relationships according to the kingdom of God. And then a model, because if you are in and around any ministry space, all the stats are coming out, like it's not going well. You know, in the last 20 years, we've lost 20% of people affiliated to the church. And in the US, it's dropped below the 50% mark for the first time. And when we think of like, well, how do we start mapping against the future? And what's a model that we need in order to say, hey, it wasn't working. The cultural shifts are changing, and the church from where I sit doesn't have all the potency to be relevant to our culture like it used to in an age that's gone by. And so, yeah, so that's what I kind of want to unpack with you and discern and kind of figure out.
Yeah. You know, when you sit there and you look at the 2000 year history of the church, right? The church was a mustard seed, right? Mustard seeds are super small. They get into the cracks between the paving stones and Roman roads. It was seen as a weed, a pest, but then they would crack the road and grow into a tree, right? And that's really what Christianity was. I mean, the prophecy in Daniel, in the book of Daniel, where he talks about this small stone that strikes the foot of the fourth and final beast, right? It strikes it, it shatters it, but that small stone grows to become a mountain. I mean, when you think about it, we were the pariahs of the empire, right? And then we became the empire, and then we became the culture. Like for 1,000 years, you could not live in Europe without bearing the fruit or receiving the fruit or participating in the Latin liturgy. Like, I mean, from the music, the artwork that donned our churches and that spread out from the churches to, you know, the other patrons of the arts, the wealthy, the aristocracy, everything was shaped and molded, at least implicitly, by the church, the gospel, right? Artwork, music, everything. And then you get to the shift of the Protestant Reformation, the fracturing of Europe, the Enlightenment, and then you have a rise of secularism, where secularism is like the new church. except it doesn't ask anything of you except don't kill your next door neighbor and then do whatever you want, as long as it's consensual, right? And so it wins the day 10 times out of 10. And you have the church becoming almost, in a sense, this mustard seed all over again, where, and I feel like it's, you know, we have what? We have WWJD bracelets and T-shirts and youth group that are a Jesus version of a, you know, a brand, like instead of Reese's Pieces, it'll be like Jesus brings you pieces or something. I don't know. But it's funny to go to reflect on someone like me, who I'm not a very cultured individual. I like to read. I'm not very fancy pants when it comes to Baroque and Rococo music and architecture. But I've walked the churches of Europe and they're gorgeous and they're empty. And I think like, oh, if only our churches in America looked like this, and if only our choirs sounded like this, it would be beautiful. It would be amazing. It would complement the faith that's there. But it's not enough. It's not enough. And what we're watching is the winnowing down, I think, in a lot of ways, of Gideon's army. You know, God's saying, you know, if the smaller you get, the more you'll know it's by my hand, right? And you start to look at, you start to see how the priesthood, like in our diocese, in the Archdiocese of Galveston, Houston, I believe the stat is we need 7 priests every year to be ordained, 7 new priests every year, for like 15 years straight, in order to cover the amount of priests that are retiring. And on average, we have 2 or 3 for our diocese. And you start to see this over and over again, and you're like, okay, Lord, what's next? Because what we've been doing for the last 20 years is leading us here to like, I mean, I had one parishioner who's not in the know, who doesn't read and research this stuff. And he's just like, what is this? Like, how are we going to survive as a church? If I don't have a priest that can hear confessions enough, let alone marry everyone, bury everyone, give last rites, make the hospital visits, aid, you know, I almost said aid and comfort to the enemy, aid, you know, aid families, you know, welcome strangers, you know, all the things that we think of like your local parish priest or even your regional parish, the stuff that we do as a mega parish. If that's even gone, if we have 5 mega parishes that one priest has to go to, well, gone are the 6 Sunday masses to give everyone communion and participation in the liturgy. How do you do that? How do you live in an age of the church when there are 50 priests for 1.4 million Catholics in Galveston, Houston? You know, like that's the new thing, that if we don't have a new model, if a new model ain't merging, you know, like ain't emerging, you know, we're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. And you talk about like smallness or littleness or like how we're being winnowed down. I actually think that there's a theme of being little in, yeah, you know, and the saints talked, yeah, about this, like all like, hey, littleness is the way of the kingdom, right? Like, yeah, littleness is the way to spiritual growth. And I actually think that that's going to be reflected in a new ministry model. And great, like gone are the days where a culture, and you know, I know Billy Graham's not Catholic, but gone are the days where Billy Graham can have like pack out a stadium and somebody can like people. I believe that people legit came to faith in those things, you know, and there's,
yeah, JP2's World Youth Days, all that,
yeah,
stuff.
And, yeah. And there are these powerful mass encounters with the gospel. But right now we see that through all the technological advances or all those kinds of things, I don't think that's going to happen anymore. I think what's going to happen, and if we just think of like, ideology is very easy to fight against. And we see that we're very quick to fight against other ideologies. But if you think about fighting against another person who's standing in front of you in relationship, having a meal with you, that's pretty hard to fight against. And I think that littleness is how the kingdom is going to grow. It's going to grow like it almost always has, as one-to-one, you know, except for these like big massive things. But I think the kingdom has always grown one-to-one in relationship. And so as we go into littleness, I think that is going to continue. And I think things like small groups that form are going to become more and more critical. But here's the big shift. Here where this is like, okay, well, yeah, we've had small groups before. Here's where the big shift happens. I've been reading this book called Dominion, and I realized for the first time in thinking it is the idea of a parish is actually, you know, a thousand-ish year old idea of how to organize our efforts in the real world, right? That was the modality of that. And it lasted a long time because that was a really great way to organize ourselves when you couldn't travel a little bit further than, you know, your horse can, or you can ride you, or you can walk. And yeah. So the parish being a centralization of that effort makes total sense. If you're mapping out the world in the days of kings and queens or kingdoms, the parish structure makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, the average human being before the invention of the modern transportation, so railway and all that stuff, lived and died within 5 miles of each other, right? So they were born and died, right, within 5 miles. They never went more than 5 miles to the point where there's this great white horse on the side of a hill in Britain that for many generations, people didn't know what it was because they lived so close to it, right? So it's this famous, this understanding that like they never ventured far. So yeah, what makes sense? Well, you take a diocese, you split it up into 100 different smaller segments. You group those segments together, what makes sense geographically, but that's your parish, that's your home. You get 3 or 4 priests, maybe 5, maybe 1. And they're there, right there in the neighborhood. They're probably all, like if you're in America in the 1900s, right? My dad and my mom grew up in ethnic neighborhoods. They were in the Irish neighborhood, right next to the Italian neighborhood in inner city Philadelphia in the 1940s and 50s. And it was funny. My dad used to sit at the street corner with a baseball bat to make sure the Italians didn't come into their neighborhood. But they all went to the same Catholic church, which was funny. But you had that weird but interesting, like ethnic enclaves within inner city America that could support that parish model. But nah, not so much.
But
not so much.
But look at this. Look at what's happening. Like even in this moment, you and I are talking. We've never met in person, but we're forming real relationship. And I think I have dozens of people who I haven't met who I actually have far deeper relationships with than those who are geographically located to me within my parish.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're ordering our effort or our ministry models against that reality enough. And the temptation is saying, okay, well, we just got to batten down the hatches, or we just got to like double down on, you know, an in-person parish structure to do more ministry. Or And I think parish revival is critical and is essential, and in person matters. It really matters. We're a sacramental people that are very incarnational in how we live. And I think that's true. And if we become too digital as a being, it's just not good for us.
Right.
But somehow we have to start orienting our effort against the world that is, not the world that has been. And I think that and we don't herald this as like we're the ones who have figured it out. We're still very much trying to figure it out on the digital, on the interaction, on the our understanding of the mind of culture. And what we want to do is discern it with people like you and with people, you know, with other people, and like, oh, how do we actually orient our efforts now? Like, how do we lead people to Jesus in real ways?
Yeah, well, let me give you an example that happened an hour and a half ago. Guy comes into my office who is responsible for our prison ministry north of I-10, so about the 80 parish or 50 parishes north of the road that splits Houston in half. And me and him are good friends, and we were talking, and he said, you know, we need to film these 10 episodes of helping Protestants become Catholic. I call it Inclusion. It's a ministry I've been running at the parish for about 6 years. And he said, we need to get this filmed. We need to get this going. We need to do this because here's the ministry life of an inmate in the state of Texas. You could literally be totally like signed to a unit. You're there. And then one day a guy walks up to you, assistant warden says, you're catching chain, 15 minutes, get your stuff, let's go. And then he's on to the other side of the state. There's 15 dioceses in our state. the other side of the state where he has to pick up his RCIA stuff. And every single time this happens, you hear the exact same reply. Well, I don't know what they did over there, so you have to start from the beginning. So you have men who are literally spending years trying to become Catholic, trying to receive the Eucharist, and they can't because they can't fulfill an in-person, run normally, you know, not to mention the men. So I'm in a really violent unit that I work with. It's a maximum security unit. And you'll have riots there, not all the time, but frequently enough that even if you didn't participate in it, you are now forbidden from going to the chapel. So you can't meet with the deacon to keep your RCIA classes going or whatever. So how do you fix the situation? Well, you get the 15 diocese correction ministries together and you begin to hash out. And it turns out they were running 11 different programs in 15 dioceses. Two dioceses weren't even running programs because they just couldn't afford it because they're, you know, more rural stuff. And then you realize, like, so now these men who are legitimately trying to pursue Christ, they get thrown into administrative segregation, right, during a riot, and now they're gone for 6 weeks. Well, guess what? All their class just came in and got baptized, you know, or whatever happened, or they got confirmed or whatever. And so we wanted to create a thing. This is where the church being so outside the digital age, and it's just now starting to catch up, but it kind of follows like old media approach. Well, we'll take this program that we aired on TV, we'll slap it together, and we'll turn it into a DVD and send it out. But our goal is like, I mean, the tricky thing is you can't have Wi-Fi in the prisons, right? So creating content that is for them, that is updated and new and continuous, but also a core content that all 15 dioceses can track with and be formed by. And I think too often we are dismissive of leveraging technology to communicate the gospel. I mean, I'm friends with Matt Frad, and he has dozens upon dozens of stories of people who watch his YouTube channel or listen to his podcast who are now Catholic. And some of them are pastors of churches, right? So you just begin to hear this and you say, okay, well, maybe we as a Catholic Church need to unleash technology, but in appropriate ways. And that's part of the, you know, the failing fast kind of thing of figuring out where we need to be with technology. I don't know. I find the default relationship is skittishness. You know, and we can't be afraid.
Yeah, I think
I read that somewhere. Be
yeah, not some afraid. somebody talked about that a bunch. Speaking of another Pope, like Pope Benedict said, hey, we have to go and evangelize the digital continent, you know? And yeah. I think him framing it that way, like we're explorers saying what else is out there in the world and let's go bring the good news. And obviously, history, as we look at history, this is problematic, like as a metaphor, but the truth of that is still true. Like there are people, yeah. We used to gather in cathedrals, right? Or in the town church. Like that was where everyone gathered. But we no longer do that. Where do we gather? We gather online. We gather digitally. We gather on social media. And it's not, you know, true gathering in what our hearts need, but it is where the discussion of the day is happening. And I think a lot more needs to happen in that. But the other parts of the new model, it's not. I think it's not only a digital thing. I think it's a in how we understand the framework of evangelization. So the phrase belong, believe, behave has kind of come out, or I've heard this belong, believe, become, or belong, believe, blessed, or I think yeah, that's
oh yeah, that's belong, yours. Believe, blessed. That's us.
And I think yeah. The most powerful thing is the ordering of it, right? Belong, believe, and then whatever is the follow up thing. But when I was a youth minister, you know, like 15, 16 years ago, I was never taught that. I was there was this undercurrent of, hey, these kids better be like good Catholic kids or you're failing at your job, right? And yeah. And yeah. I think that's different now. But I've reflected on like, why did we have a belong, believe, why did we not have a belong, believe, behave mentality? It was more like, if you behave, then we hope you believe in order to belong. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is the just the age that we came out was like people had more belonging in other spots, right? And the focus on intellectual formation in our church was because the human and spiritual formation was happening outside of the congregation. Or outside of like a context of the parish, like it was happening in the family, I think by and large. But it's no longer the case. And because families are more broken than ever, the church actually has to become family for more people. And that shifting in mentality is part of this growth to being more relevant in the culture. It's a shift that we have to go through as a parish culture and things like this. And this is not new. Like Jesus said, hey, here are your brothers and sisters. Like they are the ones who he kind of reorients what it means to be family as his ministry is unfolding in the New Testament. So yeah, the new model is broader than just technology. I think it has to integrate technology, but I also think it has to integrate these other ministry philosophies like belong, believe, behave, and this idea of family.
Yeah. I mean, what you're going to see is the lever. So software is already eating the world, right? That's a phrase that Benedict Evans, I believe, is the one that coined it. And it's so true. Like, I mean, you're going to watch automation and AI just consume entire industries, right? Like if you have a truck that can drive itself, the number one employer in any state is short distance trucking, right? You're going to lose your truckers, right? Where are they going to go? Are they going to learn to code and all that stuff? Like, come on. And so you have this this thing that software is truly eating the world. Like if you're looking at the technological revolution, yeah, the transistor was great, but it paved the way to today where every single thing is now scriptable, or at least it feels that way. But in that sense, right, you can leverage technology to, you know, create new pathways and get new content and, you know, the Roman roads of the modern world. But at the same time, what you were saying, I think, you know, the church needs to become the new family. The idea of it is the technology can also clear the way for more meaningful in-person relationships. And, you know, this is one of the things that I learned early on. All of our young people, right? Like if you have a young person on staff, all of a sudden they get assigned to be the social media person and all that stuff. One of the things that at the time she was my assistant, she created a Google form, sent an email to every ministry and just said, hey, if you want something in the bulletin, fill this out. And the Google form has a word limit cap, right? A max. And she took a job that took 4 people 20 hours a week, and she made it 10 times better, and it took her 2 to 3 hours a week to make the bulletin, which then freed her up of doing a lot more stuff. And so a lot of the things that we did was build in simple online registration forms so that if someone wanted to come to adult confirmation, RCIA, get married, you know, whatever it is, get their annulment, we captured the essentials. But the stuff that we debated, and we would sit there and discuss this stuff back and forth, what we discuss is what else are we going to capture besides, you know, age, sex, location, you know, all that stuff. And it was those things that enable our first conversation to go deeper faster, right? So that I can sit down with them and say, oh, I see you've had 2 marriages in the past and you want to pursue marriage in the church now. Do you know what an annulment is? Okay, great. Let me send you this video that walks you through the annulment process and explains it. Or I just made a new video out for our brides and grooms called Gut Check. And it is the first video, about 4 minutes long, very loving. But it says, like, are you really thinking about why you want to have a Catholic wedding, a Catholic nuptial mass? Because what we are going to do at St. Anthony's is put Christ at the center of your individual life, so that you can then put Christ at the center of your marriage. And that's why we want you to have a lifelong marriage here. But all of that stuff, right? The technology stuff, it really does. People don't understand this, that don't leverage it that much. It clears the way for better connection when you sit down, when you have to have that face-to-face or get to have that face-to-face. You can have this incredibly deep and enriching experience over and over again. So here's a couple. They don't practice. The husband was, or fiance was, born in Rome. They met in Florida. living together, playing house, doing the whole deal, right? So they come to me. They are very nervous to come to me. They don't go to church, but mom wants them to have, you know, mom's still in Italy. She wants a Catholic wedding. And they sit down and, you know, I just read through their bio. We start having a conversation. What does your Catholic faith look like? Well, you know, I received a first Holy Communion, never was confirmed. Don't really care. Okay, why? You know, then you're asking the why questions that matter the most. And the fascinating thing is they were in my office for 3.5 hours, right? Unburdening their heart. You know, I got this other guy who the diocese that he's in running circles around him, not letting him get his, never had first Holy Communion, reconciliation, or confirmation. And he wants to get married to a Catholic down here. Thank God, because their parishes up there are literally just making up canon law as they see fit. And they put so many obstacles around the sacraments. So I said, this is what you need to do. Like, none of this matters. I know the code of canon law backwards and forwards on this stuff. Focus on this. Here's some of my talks that I give to adults your age who were in your circumstance last year. I recorded the class live. We got this. Listen to these, you know, four talks on the Eucharist, on how to go to confession, you know, all this stuff. Here's the paragraphs of the catechism. I can just email them to you, copy and paste from the website, you know, and then, but I said, I'm not going to bring you in to the sacramental life of the church unless you are praying and giving your life over to God. So let me teach you how to do that. So now we have Zoom calls where I'm saying, I could never have done ministry with this guy one-on-one unless Zoom was here, unless SoundCloud, you know, it's me giving long talks plus every techno and home rapper on SoundCloud and then my talks on confession, right? And people, like, this is the thing that people don't understand is the digital age enables a parish on the other side of the country to be your home parish in a lot of ways. During the pandemic, we literally had thousands of people donate to our church because we were their mass, their go-to mass on Sundays, which is bizarre because it wasn't, you know, EWTN level quality with, you know, $80,000 cameras and swooping panning shots. And it was just a normal Sunday mass. And they said, that's what I want. I want a normal Sunday mass. Yeah. I want a mass that reminds me of home, but all they have is their, you know, iPhone on a tripod in front of the priest and I can't see everything. So, you know, and it's, yeah.
I mean, we had the same experience. We watched Father Mike Schmitz, you know, like all the way from up here in Canada. And, what I think has happened in this pandemic is like, we've jumped forward into the future. You know, I just don't think we know how far forward we've jumped. But if you think of the ministry dynamics that come with that, before, like, let's say December of 2019 or some really close, Alpha International, which is this ministry that like has kind of embraced technology and content and created like really good small groups environments for those people who aren't familiar with Alpha, been around 40 years, multiple languages all around the world, probably the most successful evangelistic tool in Christianity of our lifetime. They said, we will never do Alpha online pre-pandemic. Soon as the pandemic hit, it was like they got permission to try it because they were like, hey, this thing's not staying around. Nikki Gumbel, the pioneer of Alpha, says, we will never go back to only doing in person again, even when the pandemic's over, because they saw massive amounts of fruit. I mean, you're doing, there's this part in the Alpha course where it's called the Holy Spirit weekend or retreat or whatever. Yeah. And you're praying with people and you're seeing the Holy Spirit work on the other side of wherever, right? You know, and man, God's not limited by space and time. So why should our ministries not be reflected in the same way? And I think that we've jumped forward into the future. I just don't know how far. And now the world is going to expect it, which I think is, maybe this resonates with you. Before the pandemic, like, I would do phone calls with people all the time. Now the default is we do Zoom or, you know, some sort of video conferencing. And I was like, oh, that's, it's just, but I get to know people. It's better and it's worse at times, but it's just is the, you know, the new normal is that we're going to connect more with each other digitally. And studies are showing that our brains are actually rewiring to see cell phones as an extension of our person. which is frightening and fascinating at the same time. So
yeah, like here's a case in point, I think, that illustrates the unpredictability of what's going to happen because of technology that COVID pushed us into. So, you know, most businesses did not want remote workers, right? They feel like if the boss can see you, that's how the boss knows you're working. A lot of high tech firms, yeah, they're all over the globe, but most traditional businesses aren't, let alone parishes and stuff like that. So what we saw with COVID was entire downtown shut down so that workers had to work from home, right? So now you have this massive demand on your cable internet, your broadband connection. Now you have people advocating for, you know, terabyte connections, 2 terabyte, like they're going nuts with all of this stuff because it's not enough. It's not enough, right? You need high quality, all this stuff. But the fascinating thing that I think is you're going to see, at least to a certain extent, a democratization of the small to mid-sized town or city, right? So Indianapolis, right? St. Louis, Tulsa, all these towns that didn't achieve true big city status, right? Like the top 20 cities, right? Your San Franciscos, your LAs, your Houstons, Dallas, they're getting passed over and they were dying. But the real estate there was almost too good to be true, right? I mean, it was so cheap, so affordable, so accessible. You're surrounded by so much stuff. You have so much less crime, less pollution, less. But the companies weren't there. They were just building on top of each other in San Francisco, crushing everyone. You know, the poverty line in San Francisco was like $110,000 a year. If you make less than that, you're considered in the poverty line. Like, it's just insane. But now that almost every company to almost 100% has at least accepted remote learning, think about what that could do for your local community. Because now hometown boy made good by going to San Francisco or New York gets to stay home. Think about what that does to the neighborhood parish, right? You're not having the flight of people who define freedom by getting away from my parents, getting away from my family post-college, getting to the big city. It's like, well, as long as I have fast enough internet, I can make I can now pull in a six-figure salary staring at a screen, you know? And there's a lot of drawbacks to that. And I don't want to pretend like it's not. But we don't know how the market, how society, and how the church is going to respond to these things. And, you know, Apple had a misfire with their Apple stores. I don't know if you know this. Apple stores, the most money per square foot of any store in the world, right? And everything that Apple does is the most, right? You know, it's just insane. Apple makes more money in one quarter on iPhone sales than all of Microsoft combined for a year. Like, that's just wild. Their head of retail said the Apple store is going to become, because there's so many visitors, is going to become the new town square, the new town center. And so they started putting trees in all of them and buying the stores on the right and the left and expanding them. But people just wanted to buy the new phone, look at the new thing, and get their thing fixed, right? No one did that. No one turned it into a town center. And I've been to the New York City flagship. You're like, okay, cool. Can I just have my phone service, please? Like, but that's what the parish can be again. Like, because we live screen lives and because it can only go so far, it opens up a new sacramental experience of the individual that, you know, so you find people that, like my buddy, I got a friend who checked himself into counseling because he was so depressed because of his loneliness. He would go to a 12-story building. He'd be the only person in the whole building. Besides security and maintenance, or just him in a massive, you know, downtown. So he said, I lost my mind in this. I lost it. So what did he do? He bought co-working space. He rented out co-working space. And instead of going home or going to the office building, which were the polar opposites of his life, he went to a place where there was at least other people around, you know, and that made him feel human again. While at the same time, he was doing 100% of his work via Zoom, via Skype, and via Slack and you know, email. You know, so I don't even think we can predict these new interesting models coming up.
Well, and I think, you know, I'm always trying to ponder, like, what's resonating in culture. Yeah. You know, what brands and all those stuff. And here in Vancouver, I'm pretty sure that Peloton, like, are you familiar with Peloton? It's like the thing where you ride your bike or do, you know, exercises in front of a screen with the coach or whatever. They're making more disciples than than Catholicism is in Vancouver, in this area. And I've been reflecting about that and And I'm like, what is it about those things? And then I heard Pope Francis say this weird thing to like the super niche audience. I can't even remember what it was. I think it was like to some of the priests studying in Rome. And he said, we need to develop an ecology of the mind, heart, and hands. And I was like, oh, that's it. We're really good at developing this learning environment or this understanding of like how we grow in our minds. You know, Catholicism is arguably the best in the world at that, like in thinking well. Not that there's not other smart people, but you know, Christianity has produced some of the smartest people, right? And the ability for us to think critically about our world and scientific method coming out of that, you know, blah, blah, blah. But in our age, like I haven't been taught how to feel well. And then, you know, I haven't been taught how to act well, you know, how to like do well. And I think that our culture, or the world that we live in is hijacking our nervous system at the same time. You know, so if I do spend too much time in a screen, or I live in a culture that is where anxiety is increasing all the time, my parasympathetic nervous system, and I'm not an expert in this, so like I'd love to have a conversation with somebody who is, but my parasympathetic nervous system is going, hey, we just want to like rest and digest all the time, right? Which makes that, but internally, I know that I got to kind of do work. I got to go into my sympathetic nervous system where I do actual work. But in a culture, what's on the rise? It's like Netflix and chill, right? You know, and those are the fastest ways out of, to go out of my parasympathetic nervous system into my sympathetic and back. And I think that's what we're trying to do. But we live in a culture that's hyping up our need for actual, the release of tension within our physical selves or the addressing of our incarnational reality, that if you give me community and a bike, I feel like that's amazing. You know, like, you know, or you get me in a CrossFit community. It's not because people love lifting weights. I mean, it's torture, right? But I think what they like to do is like the physicality of that with the community of that is an answer to what our hearts are longing for in this age. And I think that Catholicism is that answer. You know, it's the most physical of religions, like we sit, kneel, stand and consume, you know, and lay hands on each other and things like that. So there's a very
the smells and the bells
and it's physical. And once I think we develop that ecology of the mind, heart, and hands, I think that's part of thinking through a new ministry model principle of people need experiences. You know, we know that we don't need programs. We need, you know, journeys. We need experiences there where I can, through the fullness of myself, experience God, you know, and we're not dualistic and we're not all those kinds of things in Catholicism, but yeah, I don't know what you think about that, like that dynamic.
Yeah. You know, the problem sometimes in the church is we reduce everything about being Catholic to just going to Mass. So then what happens is we then ask the Mass to be more than what it is, right? To be other than what it is. And even though it's the source and summit of our faith, it does not exhaust all that it means to be a Christian. And I think one of the things that we lose when you say, are you a practicing Catholic? They mean, do you at the bare minimum go to every Sunday and holy day of obligation, your Mass responsibility? And it's funny because we don't think that way when it's about loving your neighbor, serving the poor, burying the dead, and all the other corporal and spiritual works of mercy. We don't think, like, are you practicing that? Of course I am. I fed the poor the other day. Like, what does it mean to practice your Catholicism? Right? It means to be conformed to the image of Jesus Christ, right? It means to take up your cross every day and follow after him. And I think with all the dispensations to Sunday obligation, with all of the, you know, sitting down on a couch and watching the Mass in your PJs and calling that full conscious and active participation, I think that it also exposes, COVID exposed a lot of the failures in our catechesis and our models that we were approaching church. Like, yes, we are a Eucharistic church. In a way, all of the sacraments lead us to the Eucharist because the Eucharist is Jesus. But at the same time, right, Christ commissions us lay folks to go out into the world, and we don't want to because it's cold and it's scary and they don't like us, and oh well, we still have to go, right? And it's fascinating because when you stripped us of our obligation, it's now harder to get Catholics to go back to Mass, right? So like right now, we're not even at 50%. We're wide open. Anyone can come, no mask, sit anywhere you want, communion on the tongue, all that stuff. But at the same time, less than 50% of our Sunday attendance is back. And you're like, this doesn't make any sense. How does this? Well, guess what COVID just exposed? When people can sit there and sit on a couch and chill and watch the Mass, watch the liturgy and chill, right? See what I did there?
Yeah,
see what
yeah,
I did there?
Yeah.
Yeah. But all of a sudden it takes on, it gives you your Sunday back, wouldn't you know it, right? You don't have to come. You don't have to get four kids and wedge them in a minivan and fight them all the way to Mass and fight them during Mass. And you don't have to hear a priest give you the side eye because your kids are disruptive. Oh, because they haven't been at Mass in 8 months or 12 months or whatever, right? Like it becomes this, like, every negative thing, I feel like, where you're talking about the hijacking of your nervous system. It's like it's almost like we are more prone to be more anxious and more depressed, so we just are looking for more things to numb us. And yeah, you can fall asleep in the pew, but liturgy really doesn't numb you. Serving the poor doesn't numb you. Our food pantry that serves more people than every other institution except the major state-funded food bank. You go serve over there, right? There's no numbing agent there. You are fully alive. When you are seeing someone in a brand new Lexus SUV roll up to get groceries because they can't sell their car, they can't, they're upside down on the payments, they got fired, and now the unemployment checks are gone, and now they can't feed their family one meal. So they roll up to get some hamburger helper, right? Like, being Christ's hands and feet in those situations, that's how you come alive. So then we have to expand our notion. Are you a practicing Catholic, right? Like, what do you mean by that? Well, you do the bare minimum, or are you living the life of being conformed to Christ Jesus? You know?
Yeah, practicing Catholic. It's funny how the model is shifting to the evangelical strategy of the last maybe 30, 40 years was invite your friends to church. Invite your friends to church. And you know, I'm not an expert in this, so I don't know if that, like, if that culture just transferred to, like, invite your friends to Mass, invite your friends to Mass, as if somehow they would magically, like, understand it with zero formation and all that kind of stuff. But all that aside is that I think, like, everyone who was going to get invited or either chose not for me, I'm not ever going, or they went and became a Christian or they didn't, you know? So I think that that model that has run its course, and now it's about us going, where do we go? And Pope Francis did this thing that seemed really weird to me at first. He released this letter, like, I don't know, a month and a half ago, about the office of catechist. And I feel and it kind of, like, no one really said anything about it. Like, it was pretty under the radar. But I think that there's a genius to it that's, hey, we need to make room for people to go to unique places in order to be able to form people in this way. We need to be able to catechize people in unique ways. And hopefully, you know, like, that translates to unique spots. Because I was born and raised in South Africa. So the catechists in Africa are very different from our kind of North American understanding. They'll go and you won't see Mass for a long period of time because of, you know, priest shortage and things like that. These are the martyrs of our time in Africa. And I think that model applied to our kind of context, create some really interesting ideas of how the faith is going to start spreading. It's going to start spreading in homes. It's going to start spreading in small communities, in that littleness again. And I think that's powerful, because once it catches, it's pretty hard to put out, even by a culture that doesn't like it or disagrees with it or things like that. So there's opportunities that are going to emerge that have never existed before. And I think that, that's if we can get all of this right, it starts tying that all this new ministry model opportunity stuff together.
Yeah. And, you know, we really are in a new age where everyone is connected to one another. And, you know, you talked about this is bigger than the printing press. You know, I'm an old school guy. I'm a Cal Newport guy. I'm a digital minimalist. I do have a Facebook page, but I never update it. I never go on it. I have a banner that says Facebook is evil. But the idea that in the printing press that you could cheaply reproduce books. Martin Luther even said that he was shocked to discover that his books were being read. I believe it was in Sweden. And he's like, how did they even get them? Like, how is it that my books, you know, whatever is being read all the way up there? But it's funny because it's instantaneous. I mean, the moment you publish a blog post, an article, post a video, an audio file, it is simultaneously available to everyone in the world who their governments allow them to connect to it, right? And so you just think about, like, there's a Protestant pastor, John MacArthur, and he talks about, you know, they stream the sermons on the internet, and there's a guy who's been recording his sermons, and he takes them and he puts them on USB stick MP3 players. And he puts them on like 200 or 300. And then he lives in South Korea. And then he takes these and he goes to rice farmers in rural villages. And these units all have, you know, built-in play pause control. They kind of look like an old iPod shuffle and headphones. And as they're working the rice fields, they're getting this guy from Southern California, right? This reformed, independent, you know, church guy, giving these sermons, and they're learning English and they're learning scripture and they're learning his particular angry branch of reformed reformed Christianity. But within all that, like, just think about that. Like, the poorest of the poor, maybe they can't even read, but they can listen. And if you can get it in their language, all of a sudden you've now rapidly expanded the ability of your congregation to learn. Mm-hmm. You know, you just have to make it appealing enough that they'll want to, you know?
Yeah. The one thing that I wanted to go back to is what it means to be a practicing Catholic.
Yeah.
I'll make a prediction. I actually think, you know, if the model is not invite people to church anymore, I think the model is going to be a deep focus on a way of life. And as you talked about digital minimalism and stuff like that, I think Christianity is going to spread when we as Christians figure out how to slow down. You know, how do we develop a way of life where we're not letting culture hijack our nervous system, where we're not letting our emotions flow with the, you know, whatever the issue of the day is, and how we can be just the most relaxed people in a room. And I think like that word relaxed is like pretty powerful, because it's then that we go, whoa, man, that guy doesn't seem like he's as freaked out and anxious as I am, which the faster things go, it's just going to get more and more. Like, we're going to like, whoa, like, somebody hold on. And I think that only happens when our way of life is a reflection of a relationship with Jesus, that the fullness of our day is reoriented towards those things. And I think the message of that has always been there, but it's just been coaxed in like hard to receive language. Like, hey, you should have your quiet time and your prayer time and your, like, your devotions and like all those kinds of stuff there, which they're all great, right? We have the rhythmicness of rosary and like all those kinds of stuff. And I think that as we learn how to slow down and stay in the world, as opposed to this mentality of battening down the hatches and just separating, but slowing down in the world, people are going to have to turn their heads and look at us and go, that person has what I don't. What the heck is that? They talk about this Jesus guy a lot. And that's the fundamentals of like the world that's emerging. It's just being different. So.
Yeah. And, but sadly the constant temptation of the church is to appeal to the world. We adopt worldly means and we don't realize that we are selling off our birthright, as it were, right? So the temptation for evangelists is to constantly, and we don't think we're doing this because we think we're winning souls, but we compromise the church and what she asks of us, and we water down the honestly, the heroism of facing yourself in the morning as you truly are, right? We water it down. We don't talk about sin. We don't talk about repentance. I was just reading an article the other day about all these Democrat politicians that are the wildly out of context New York Times and LA Times piece on the USCCB on Eucharistic coherence, like totally lied and distorted what the bishops were talking about. But the reaction was, I dare you. It wasn't the governor of California. Someone in California said, I dare you to not give me Holy Communion on Sunday because I'm pro-abortion and pro-gay marriage. And the commenter said, what's a bigger, funnier thing that we're realizing is it's not just that people don't know what the real presence of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist is. They don't know what sin is. Right? They don't. And we don't have this conception of sin. And so, and I tell this to people all the time. I tell this to priests all the time. Don't be afraid to preach sin and repentance from sin, because that is what's going to help people find freedom. But it becomes uncomfortable. But that freedom is, it's like a birth canal, right? It is uncomfortable for the baby and the mama. It is uncomfortable for the priest and the soul the priest is preaching to. But what you see on the other side is new life, right? It's new life. And so one of the crazy things that I feel like for an evangelist to keep people in the church, we do this desperate thing where we start to loosen what it means to be a part of the church. But if we stay true to what the church is asking, that's actually what draws people in. We don't think it does. We think, well, I can keep this group. The more the church becomes, you know, carnal, I can use this, you know, these people will stay if I soften the church's teaching here, amend the church's teaching there, but not to the point of heresy. But what ends up happening is that radical renunciation, that radical decision to be in the world but not of the world, is what the world can't offer worldly people, right? The world can only offer itself. And if I want something that is greater than what this world can offer, I have to go outside the world, right? Like literally, like, and God broke into the world in order to make that offer to us. And it's fascinating that you have people like Bishop Barron talk with Jordan Peterson, and Jordan Peterson say, I saw a man holding two, you know, pink Victoria's Secret bags or something like that on the street corner. He was this big dude, jacked, buff dude. And I just want to walk up to this guy and be like, you are bored out of your mind. Let me invite you to an adventure. And he's like, why isn't the church doing that? And we're not doing that because for us, the adventure was going to Mass on Sunday and believing all the right things. And it's like, okay, that's a good starting point. But what does it mean to be a practicing Catholic, right? Like now we can have these challenging conversations where the people in the world can look at the church and say they're living a different life because, frankly, they are attached to something or someone rather that is beyond what this world can offer. And until we as Catholics start living from that place, I think we're just going to see more hemorrhaging from our churches and parishes and
yeah
stuff.
And you know, understanding what sin is, like I don't want to downplay any of the church teaching on like how much it damages or like that God is not sin and like he doesn't like it and all that kind of stuff. But the other thing is like when we get to name our sins, you know, and as I look at my life story and I examine the sins that have plagued me throughout my lifetime, I realize that those are all signposts of where I was broken. And in being yep. able to invite Jesus into the brokenness and not being attached to like, is this a sin or not? And do I have to like degrade my theological understanding of the world in order to like feel okay about my moral compass? But when I don't have to do that and I can just say, oh, sin, this was sinful. And it was actually, that's where I'm broken. And then I can get fixed. And I feel like we talk about sin not as much as we talk about freedom. Mm-hmm. And freedom is that thing that, if we can ask somebody, hey, would you rather, I'll give you permission to hold on to your sin, or I can make you free and not want the sin anymore. I feel like we don't have that second part of the conversation enough.
Right.
And right. if we could, I think that would drastically shift even the comfort level of like, what is sin and how is it? You know, I know it disappoints, you know, like to some degree, but the Father's not sitting up there going like, I'm so disappointed in you. He's going, man, I want the very best for you. And there's a greatness within you that this is holding you back from. And addressing that kind of stuff is what's going to, bring out the masculine heart, bring out the feminine heart. And, it's going to be the renewal.
Just right there. Think about, the online phenomenon that is OnlyFans, right? OnlyFans is, for the most part, it is a porn pipeline that you subscribe to. Okay. So here's the crazy thing about OnlyFans. Why are so many men paying subscription fees to individual models to take their clothes off and jump around and do weird, funny, silly stuff, whatever it might be, that they try to get away with on Twitch? All these streamers, these online streamers, why are they paying subscription if it's just about the nudity and the sex? Because you can get that for free online. Right. You can type in any keyword, do a search, find a video. Right. And then you can get your jollies. Why are they flooding OnlyFans? What's that one? They release the stats every year. Pornhub. Right. Biggest pornography website in the world. They try to be so legit. Like they do their annual State of the Union of their company and stuff. But they're trying to adopt the model of OnlyFans into their network. All these people are trying to do this. Why? Why would someone subscribe? It's not just about the nudity. It's faux intimacy. It's risk-free. And I'm renting a friend, right? Like, they crave interaction. The men who go on OnlyFans are the loneliest men, right? And they buy their 15 minutes or however much it is from this beautiful, adorable, wonderful, voluptuous, whatever character they've chosen, right? They subscribe to this woman. But then you find out, I was listening to this fascinating talk the other day about the women of OnlyFans and how they are the loneliest women.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of them, it's like 80% of the women who start on OnlyFans, they lose their boyfriends or long-term relationships. They walk away from it, all this stuff. And then the men on OnlyFans try to hunt, find them and semi-stalk them online. And so they would never date their subscribers, but they'll happily take their money, right? But they themselves are losing their long-term relationships and short-term relationships that their lives are becoming cheapened. So then they get locked into doing more and more online web content, all this stuff. And it becomes this vicious cycle. You don't talk about hijacking your nervous system, right?
Mm.
But then you look at that. So how do I preach into that? Do I just sit there and condemn the pornographic nature? If I do that, I'm going to miss the essential brokenness that people are longing for, right? And that's where you begin to address the profound and systemic loneliness at the heart of modern culture, right? That is divorcing intimacy from sex in general, from sexuality, sexual expression, all that stuff. But it's divorce. And it's commoditizing like slices of friendship. Like, you get me from 215 to 235 and then deposit more money in the coin slot, please, or no. I'm moving on. And these people, like in Japan, they're well ahead of the curve. They have people who rent girlfriends like a Zoom call and they just eat dinner together. Right. And then they end their dinner and then they go back into their bedrooms. Like, that's it. I'm done. Like, that's where I think what you're saying with the profound brokenness, like, these are the sins I'm using to medicate something else that's there or that's not there that should be there, right? And who can supply that hurt? Who can fill that void? Who can heal that wound? Maury Povich, more YouTube woodworking channels, you know, like another hour and a half on endlessly scrolling on Instagram? No. You know, it can't. It can't.
Yeah.
Right?
And I don't feel like all these, there's no simple answer to any of these things. Right. Like, how do you start engaging? But we have to, you know, and I think that that's the world that's just going to continue. And it's amazing how even in early Rome, the same thing is true. And it started, the gospel started resonating with women and slaves and they were converted because it offered them some, a freedom of somebody who was publicly mocked and treated like a prisoner and a slave, and preaching Christ crucified was the growth of the gospel. And yeah, I feel, you know, it's been pretty amazing trying to like unpack that with you. So
yeah, thanks for having me on, and you know, I can always rant and rave about the church today.
Yeah, so can I. But it's beautiful that we can have some sort of level of productivity in talking about it too, and hopefully start a conversation with other people, invite other people into that of saying, hey, if we start thinking about, you know, the parish structure, we start thinking about like what's resonating in our culture and what technology can be, how do we interact with people who are interacting with technology in order to bring the gospel? I feel like there's a lot of good news there. And I do think that what's happening is going to take decades to kind of unfold. This new ministry model is going to take decades, but I think it's going to transform the way we do church for 500 to 1,000 years. And so it's worth really diving into the conversation now so that, we end up being able to be faithful to what's been asked of us in our day. And I think that's what this whole thing is about anyways. So it's been great having you on. It's been great, you know, kind of co-doing the show together and looking forward to having more conversations.
Yeah, it was awesome. Thank you.
Cool. Hey, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. And if you have any insight into what the principles of a new ministry model for the church could look like, we'd love to hear them. Drop a comment or send us an email at jason@glasscanvas.io. And if you like the show, please consider subscribing. It really helps us out. And we look forward to seeing you on the next one.